Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Stretching nearly the entire length of the eastern seaboard of the continent, Britain's American colonies are considered to be the earliest manifestation of the great drama that is the modern United States. While the period is often mythologized as one of sameness, history has shown that these 13 colonies were defined early on by what made them different, and were only united upon the formation of a new, revolutionary identity. On this episode, we discuss Britain's American colonies. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. In Season 1 of the series, we're discussing the colonial frontier of North America, the people and ideas that shaped it, and the places and events that changed its history forever. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared. You can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, find updates on news and events on my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, and of course, please visit your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode of Wartime, we're discussing a topic very familiar to many of us, although understood by very few of us. We're going to be discussing the British Empire in North America before 1763, the 13 colonies that made it up, and some of the lesser-known subtle nuances that go into really understanding who they are, how they form, and how they change America forever. When we think of colonial America, we can often make the mistake that it's a very homogeneous place. We think of it as very singular, we think of it as very straight-laced, it's a subject we're very comfortable with. That's largely because for most of our experience as children and in popular culture, we're force-fed images of powdered wigs and tricorn hats. And yes, that was part of it. But it's a very misleading part of it, because that was not the core of the colonial American identity. And when we talk about empires and conflict, as we will in the series and future episodes, it's not going to serve us if we don't truly understand just who these people are and where and why they feel the way they do. Empires in competition are the best forms of empires in many cases, as far as success and growth. But we're breaking down the barriers and we're breaking down the misconceptions about North America in this regard. And in this episode, we're focusing on the English settlers. You know, one of the great things I love about America today is that if you travel, you'll see that regardless of where you are, regardless of who you're speaking to, there is a unique strand of Americanism that you can find in all corners of this continent. Now, that being said, you also, I think, in a much more open way, in a much more visible way, can tend to see the major differences between someone who's from the North compared to someone who's from the South compared to someone who's from the West. And we know even more than that, those sub-regions have their subdivisions. That is part of the American story. It's an incredibly diverse culture. Many people look at the diversity in this country in the 21st century as a weakness. I promise you, historically, it isn't. But you must also understand that America has always had that element of diversity. Multiple groups from multiple places coming together, seeking many of the same things, but often going about achieving those goals in different ways. I'd like to talk about the 13 colonies as we know them, and talk to you how historians view them. Because regardless of the misconception or mythology or understanding of these places that you think you have, more often than not, what you find is that the historical record does not reflect those opinions in any way whatsoever. When we think about the American colonies, again, we have to have a view of what a colony is in general, because you can't understand how they develop and how they grow before you understand why they're there. Now, we talked about the purpose of colonization in great details in previous episodes, and I'd encourage you to look at those. But when you think about colonies, again, this is a way of expanding an empire, and therefore expanding a worldview. It doesn't matter so much how the people live in the colonies, as much as it does early on, who lives there. If we can all visualize ourselves in London as a group of 17th century imperialists, one of the things we would find is that we'll do whatever it takes to move English people into our English colonies. Because they may live in slightly different ways, all cultures are unique and diverse, even within themselves, but as long as they're living in a uniquely English way, they are accomplishing their intended goal. So let's break down the American colonies, those what we call 13 colonies. An identity, by the way, that for most of American history in terms of its colonial period, most people would never recognize that term. All colonies are different. They behave differently. They view the world in their own ways differently. In the British sense, they would all say, yes, we have a British identity or an English identity. But they have their own systems that work for them. When we look at America's diversity today between, say, North and South, you'll see that these people can be at times very different. And those differences find their origins all the way back in the 17th century. Let's start again with the breakdown. Colonies of the North, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire, we collectively call the New England colonies, and we group them together not as separate entities, but as very similar colonial types, because the way they view the world and the expectation they have from the empire is very similar. As you move further south, we get to a region we call the Middle Colonies. Those colonies are Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Delaware. These people are very different than their neighbors to the north, and they're likewise be equally different than their neighbors to the south. Moving further south down the coast, we'll get to the Chesapeake Bay region, Virginia and Maryland, with their own unique system and outlook on life. Going beneath that, we have what's known in the colonial period as the Low Countries. They'll eventually be called the Southern Colonies, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. Now again, in the modern sense, we collectively call these the 13 colonies. They're bundled together in North America. They must have a shared identity. And that's an identity that will develop, but it's not one that's present right away. And it's in those periods where they don't have that cohesive view that we see the real origins geographically of how the American colonies all develop very differently and very separately from one another. Beginning in New England, we see the major push factor out of England and the major pull factor to the New World not being some sense of spreading the English way of life, not being some sense of getting rich with some impressive cash crop. But we see the major driving force be religious persecution. At least that's the story. The people that will first travel to New England are a far right sect of Anglicans known as the Puritans. And we know the story. They come to America seeking religious freedom. But that is perhaps a rose-colored way of viewing things, because there's actually much more practical examples of why they come. But I think in some of the most fascinating interpretations are the fact that these early Puritans, are actually, in fact, religious separatists. They're not seeking the freedom for all people to worship how they like, but they're largely seeking the freedom to worship how they'd like. They have very little room for any type of conversation regarding other faiths. So we say religious freedom may be a generic term. As Americans, we appreciate that. But religious freedom was not likely to be found in colonial New England. What you had instead was religious isolation. The idea that we, as Puritans, would like to worship the way that we'd like, and we've got very little interest in anyone else doing it any other way. They wanted to build their own religious utopia, and it was a Puritan one from the beginning. So what that breeds is an intense fear of outsiders, an intense suspicion of non-Puritans in the region. It's no wonder that we see something as extreme and as far-flung in the 1690s as the Salem Witch Trials. This is a naturally insular, suspicious society in New England. And that's a very different society, although they're speaking the same language, that you'll find anywhere further south. So New England has its own feel, it has its own texture, it has its own flavor, in a way. But it is unique to those five colonies, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Vermont. Moving further south, we'll take a look at the Chesapeake Bay region, the Virginias and the Marylands. Now, Virginia, we know, is the first colony successfully established in the New World by the English. And the reason that the city of Jamestown on the James River is successful is its ability to procure a highly valuable, very profitable cash crop. And that cash crop is tobacco. Tobacco is really the first raw material that gets an English foot firmly planted in the Western Hemisphere. The Spanish, we've discussed them, were pulling gold and silver from the earth. The English weren't that lucky. But fortunately for them, the naturally occurring grass of tobacco was something that is highly, highly regarded by the European world. And you can really only get it along the shores of the Chesapeake Bay. So while farther north in New England, you've got this very insular, deeply religious, separatist society that is New England in the 17th century. Further south in the Chesapeake Bay, you see people who care very little for outward expressions of religion, at least in regard to outward expressions of profit, because tobacco is a highly profitable cash crop. It's a cash crop, incidentally, that early on, almost anyone can grow, but as the system develops, as the true wealth begins to pour into the colony, it becomes very clear that only the very wealthy and powerful really can successfully grow tobacco in enough quantities to make money. So tobacco for the new Chesapeake Bay region becomes a symbol of wealth and power. We have a terrible habit in the Western world of not honoring and not coveting our greatest heroes, our greatest servicemen, our soldiers and our firefighters and our police officers. But we often, too many times, put the most value on people with the most stuff, right? It's the reason we keep up with the Kardashians. We want the money, we want the jets, we want the cars, we want the big homes. But we equate all of those things with wealth and therefore with success. And in the 17th century, these individuals in the Chesapeake Bay region did the same. For them, the wealthy and powerful grew tobacco. Tobacco requires a large amount of land. You need to regularly rotate them. A person with a small plot couldn't do that. They're very expensive plants and very profitable. But you need to have cash in hand before you can grow successfully. So the very rich have a leg up in that regard. In the Chesapeake Bay region, a tobacco culture develops. A historian named T.H. Breen published a book called Tobacco Culture, and he showed in many ways that the tobacco growers were the pinnacle of the social hierarchy in the Chesapeake Bay region, and he's correct. Tobacco by a plant is not that impressive, but tobacco is viewed as a mechanism of wealth is entirely impressive. So there we see the Chesapeake Bay region, those two colonies, Virginia and Maryland, have their own unique feel. That idea, that overarching avarice for growing cash crops and making money will pour into the southern colonies as well. The North Carolinas, the South Carolinas, and the Georgias. But there, things are different. The rules don't apply as much. It's much hotter. It's much more humid. Some parts of North Carolina can still grow tobacco, but for the most part, in the depths of those colonies, it's far too hot to grow tobacco. It's a very temperate plant. But the desire for wealth through a cash crop is present. So in those low countries, new cash crops are developed. And these are cash crops that are very different, lead-in, than the well-known and beloved plant of tobacco in Virginia. They begin to grow rice. They begin to harvest indigo. And the difference between these crops and tobacco, aside from the obvious biological differences, are the fact that to make money with them, because they grow faster and they grow easier and they're in much more supply, you need to grow as much of it as possible. So the plantation system that really centers around the Chesapeake Bay region, Virginia and Maryland, very much is transplanted in the South. But it's transplanted in a different way. The plantations are much bigger in the southern colonies. The plantations have much more activity. While you may not be harvesting tobacco at any given time in Virginia, one time in the year you might do that. In the southern colonies, you're always harvesting rice and you're always planting rice because you need to sell it in mass quantities to make a similar kind of financial return. So if there's a feel for the Carolinas, it's very much an extension of what we see in Virginia. But there's also something very different about it. And the difference is this. In one word, it's African slavery. But the difference is this. In one word, it's slavery. In 1737, a northern colonist visited the Low Countries, the southern colonies, the Carolinas. And he made the comment that the Carolinas appear to be more like a Negro country than a country settled by white people. That was in 1737. And what's he trying to say? Well, the plantations are so big, and the work demand for labor is so great, African slavery really finds its first grasp of being a way of life in those very southern colonies. Now, for the people of New England, certainly there was examples of slavery there, but nothing on the massive, almost industrial scale, so to speak, that you'd see in the southern colonies. So again, they're very different people. In the 1690s, when we see the Salem witch trials, you'll see individuals in places like Virginia and the Carolinas looking on in this in terror and horror. How can these people who call themselves Englishmen behave this way? We can't fool ourselves into believing that colonial America is a homogeneous place. We can't fool ourselves into thinking all the people are on the same page. Because as we'll see as the series progresses, they're often on opposite sides of many very important issues. But what about those colonies in the middle? The Pennsylvanias, the New Jersey, Delaware, and New York region. Well, aptly enough, they're known as the Middle Colonies. Because unlike those other territories, they don't have that one defining feature that sets them apart. New England has this intense streak of religious separatism. The Carolinas have this unnatural avarice and greed and desire for African slavery to support their way of life. In the Chesapeake Bay, you've got this almost sense of American entitlement or American royalty in the 17th century. But what of the middle colonies? Well, they're a bit of a blend of both. That may be the one feature that distinguishes them. They're a bit of everything all around them. Pennsylvania has a religious origin. New Jersey, Delaware, these are places that share some unique religious qualities. But the idea of the middle colonies is they sort of blend all the people who are north and all the people who are south together in a unique way of life. Now, it's not to say that's done intentionally, but it is a bit of geography. Now, perhaps there is something more we can say about the makeup of the middle colonies. Well, in the middle colonies, for the example of Pennsylvania, William Penn founded the colony on the notion of religious freedom, equal and fair rents and payments for all people, regardless of race, creed, ethnicity, or religion. So there is that sense, religious freedom does exist. It's not in New England, not where we think. But in the 17th century, it's in the middle colonies. So because of that, you'll see large amounts of European dissidents, people who are considered outsiders, people who are prejudiced against because of their faith, moving into the middle colonies. You see groups like Germans and Swiss becoming ethnic European minorities in the New World, and you really don't find that in most other places. The English have a strong grasp on the population of New England and the Chesapeake Bay and the Carolinas, but the middle colonies have this unique sociological makeup. So perhaps that may be their defining feature. Some would also say their defining feature in the middle colonies may be the urban village, the notion of an early city emerging. Now, Boston is certainly the heart of New England, Charleston, the dominant city of the southern colonies, but the middle colonies are home to places like New York City and Philadelphia, the two largest and most populous cities in the 17th and early 18th centuries in America. So already, just in that discussion, we're seeing these are all actually very different places. They share the same English origins, but they're different nevertheless. When we continue to talk about them, though, we'll see that from the vantage point of London, from the vantage point of England, they're really not that different at all. And in that misconception, you see some of the earliest origins of the American Revolutionary period, and certainly the ideas that drive them. But before we begin to talk about this cohesive drive toward revolution, we have to get back to the crux of the lecture, and that is, of course, where the American identity comes from. Now, there's a number of indicators we can use to take the pulse of the American people in the 18th century. And you can take this from any number of perspectives. But I always like to look at religion as a great benchmark, as a great glimpse into the soul of America, how America views itself, because I think it's very useful in that regard. And one of the best examples we have of this when trying to pin down American identity is found in the colony of Georgia in 1738. At that time, a young man named George Whitefield, an Anglican minister trained at Oxford, will arrive in America. And when he comes, he decides to bring with him a new surge of religious fervor that's being seen in Europe. And it's a zealous religious fervor. It's a sense of enjoyment and a sense of satisfaction and a thrill of devotion that is conspicuously absent in the New World in this part of the 18th century. Now, George Whitefield comes with a basic idea. And the idea he's dealing with is how we view not only our world, but more specifically, how we view our faith. He gives dynamic, exciting, very spiritual, but also very entertaining sermons. And this is something that most people in 1738, especially in the American colonies, have yet to experience. Whitefield will grow in esteem, he'll grow in prestige, he'll become known as one of the most powerful voices in religion in the New World in the 18th century. And word of his sermons being so dynamic, being so exciting, quickly circulate throughout the colonies. Now, Whitefield will take on a number of fundraising expeditions, and these expeditions are not very exciting, but it takes them to all different corners of the American colonies. He preaches in North Carolina, he preaches in Virginia, he preaches in the middle colonies in Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey. He preaches in New England. And everywhere he goes, there seems to be a desire, there seems to be a thirst for the style of religion that he's preaching. Now, there's nothing inherently, at least dogmatically, different than all tenets of the Anglican faith, but it's his delivery, and it's the ideology that drives his delivery that will largely be the reason for his success. He says, conventional norms indicate that we must worship in a quiet way. We must worship in a church on Sunday for a set amount of times, only singing certain hymns, and never losing control of ourselves, never fully expressing our emotions. It's very quiet, it's very calm, and he would say in some ways, it's very intentionally depressed. That's the view he brings. But when Whitefield preaches, it's an exciting, it's a dynamic, it's an enthralling sermon. And it gets people very excited. And he's not challenging the church. That's very important. But he's simply challenging accepted norms. He says this in Pennsylvania. He says this in New Jersey. He says it in Virginia and Maryland and the Carolinas. All places, at least in the minds of the people who live there, that are very different, even different at a fundamental level. They are all English colonies. They are all British. But that's the end of the similarities. And yet Whitefield, a man who comes from a tradition separate from all of those colonies, is wildly successful in each and all of them. So what a powerful idea. In Whitefield's mind, clearly there's something that unifies these colonies in a way that they aren't seeing. Think of this. In 3 days, Whitefield will speak to almost 20,000 people. And that's without a microphone. That's without amplification. This is a charismatic man of the highest order. Benjamin Franklin, whenever Whitefield visits Philadelphia, gives us a great little quote on this topic. He says that when he begins to hear Whitefield speak, he makes a promise to himself silently that he will not give this man a penny. And yet by the end of it, he couldn't reach into his pockets fast enough. So this is Franklin, a man who values a certain distance from his faith and his reason mixing together. And even he is opening his coffers for Whitefield. So what is Whitefield? Why does he have so much success? And what does it tell us? Well, what we can say is Whitefield does not cause any major shift in the way Americans view themselves. But he clearly is revealing something bigger at play. We'll say as historians that Whitefield is an indicator. Again, he's not a catalyst of change, but his success indicates that change is occurring. Now, Whitefield only talks about his faith. He doesn't talk about politics. He doesn't talk about imperial policy. He talks about religion. That's what he values. But what we're seeing is that the wheels and the gears are turning. And if Americans collectively, not as 13 separate colonies, but as a unified people, are beginning to accept his message in all corners of the 13 colonies, then clearly something is afoot that's bringing them together. Again, Whitefield is an indicator, but he's not a catalyst of change himself. So if he is an indicator, what exactly is he indicating? Well, remember, the American colonies are an extension of England in the 1730s. They're a collection of people who, as economically a whole, produce about 50% of the British Empire's entire imperial revenue. Most of the people who live in the colonies are third or even fourth generation Americans. That is, they are British, yet most of them have never ever been to England. They've never walked the streets of London. Instead, they've walked the streets of their plantations, of their small towns in New England, but they've never been to England itself. So what we're seeing is these people have no connection, other than the outward political connection, to London itself, to England itself, to the larger British world. Now, they do identify themselves as British, but we're beginning to see, and Whitefield's experience indicates this, that a new identity is also emerging as well. And that identity is an identity of Americanism. They are American. Before this time period, whether it be the end of the 17th century or even in 1720, maybe as late as 1730, you would use the word American as an adjective. It would be a describing word. You smoke American tobacco. You wear a shirt made of American cotton. But you would never say, I am American. The word just wasn't used that way. And that wasn't a matter of linguistics. That was a clear glimpse into the mind and the collective pulse of the American people, that the American identity just didn't exist yet. The word will follow when the sentiment of nationality emerges. So that's what we see here. And again, we don't want to use a word like the 13 colonies to describe North America's holdings in the British world, because they wouldn't have used that themselves. They're all very different. Yet Whitefield, as an indicator, this religious exploratory activity, shows us that there is a bond forming. His success reveals that. So what is this bond? Well, again, it gets back to Whitefield's message. Americans aren't necessarily, we as historians believe, responding to Whitefield's saying. At face value, yes, they are. But they're responding to his line of thought. Conventional norms tell us church has to look a certain way. Practicing your faith has to look a certain way. But now he's presenting an alternative. He's presenting what many will begin to describe as the freedom to choose. And people in this time are making decisions like that everywhere, not just in religion. If you can challenge church doctrine, why not challenge imperial doctrine? Why not challenge economic doctrine? We're talking about the age of the Enlightenment in the middle of the 18th century. And the Enlightenment is a very European idea. Now, the Atlantic Ocean is big, and it may stop armies, and it may stop invasions, but if there's one thing we know that it can't stop, it's ideas. America is still connected to the European world. It's an extension of it. And the Enlightenment is a time period of challenging convention, asking questions, not because someone allows it, but because the societal pulse has changed, the opinion has changed. Challenging a government issue, challenging a law before, throughout most of human history, would cause you to lose your head. You'd be punished, you'd be jailed, or you'd be executed. But now, in the Enlightenment, there's been a radical shift to the left. And you can ask these questions without fear of reprisal. The Enlightenment is a wholly European development. But in a lot of interesting ways, it's really applied to its fullest in America. So why is that? Well, it's a matter of interpretation. English philosophers like John Locke, French philosophes like Jean-Jacques Rousseau or Voltaire will all write about challenging government. They'll write about the rights of man and his role in this world. But they'll never put that challenge into practice. The first major revolution we see come from the Enlightenment is not in France and it's not in England, but it's in America. So why is that? It's not the home of these ideas, at least in their inception, but it is the home of their application. I like to say that revolution in America, Enlightenment ideals, has a home field advantage in the New World. Back in England, back in France, yes, you can talk about the theories of self-governance, but you can't apply them. The empire, the king, his henchmen, if you would, are always right around the corner. The proverbial state is always watching, and they are very good at locating people with seditious ideas and putting them into prison. And that, of course, is true for many hundreds of years. But now in America, now that a collective American identity is forming, these Enlightenment values find a real home. Because the empire, the king, his henchmen, right? The word we like to use so much, but isn't really reflective. It does have a very clear emotional value, though. Are an ocean away, right? You can not only talk about rebellion and talk about self-governance and talk about revolution, but you can do it. Those ideas can fester. They can grow. Remember, rebellion is a very infectious idea. And while you can't get away with that in Europe, you certainly can in the New World. So what a powerful idea. Revolution has a home field advantage, but it can't come until a cohesive identity is formed. And using Whitefield as an indicator, and he is one of many indicators, we see that by 1738, 1740, the notion of, yes, being British And yes, being a Virginian or a Pennsylvanian and having loyalty to your colony is in place. But there is this new twist. Being English is not a value the Americans have. They are British. They are part of an imperial world. But they aren't the same as the people back in Europe. And we'll see this time and again. Prominent Americans, men like Benjamin Franklin, men like Benjamin Rush, men of very high esteem here in the colonies, will go to England, and they'll be treated as second-class citizens in many regards. They'll go there expecting to be treated as equals. And when they get there, they notice there's a unique prejudice against them. If you are a wealthy, prominent American, the English will find a fault. They will say, yes, you're a man of wealth, but you're a man of commercial wealth. In England, we are born with prestige, and that value remains. The notion of being a self-made man almost takes you down a tier in England in the 18th century. They'll talk about your carriages in the New World. Yes, they're fine, but they're not gilded. They don't have that quality of gold and craftsmanship to them. There's always something rougher. There's always something lesser about a colonist. And this is something that a man like Benjamin Franklin sees very early on. Now, he'll come back to the New World, and he'll talk about something he calls his Albany Plan. It's about 1754, and what he wants to do is form a colonial legislature of the 13 colonies in North America. But the issue is, it'll never move forward. The sentiment is there in some cases, but the politics aren't. Now, Benjamin Franklin will also talk about forming a Continental Congress again in the future, about 20 years in the future, and by then, the ideas and the perceptions have changed enough that that's possible. But by 1754, Franklin's a visionary, but he's a lone visionary. The general population is not willing to accept that this American identity is prominent enough and profound enough to really sway them to do something as radical and unusual as forming a colonial legislature with all 13 colonies acting as one. They just aren't there yet. But the identity is growing. And we have to understand this if we're going to understand where the revolution, and really the revolutionary period as a whole that we're discussing here in season one of Wartime, really comes from. Remember, these events do not just fall from the sky. They don't just happen at random. There are no coincidences. And when you view colonial America as homogenous, when you view colonial America as singular, you miss all of that very important information. And what you get is a very face value understanding of the period. But it's not there enough, and it doesn't do justice to the advances we've made historically to understanding the period. So, we have this new American identity, but how far will it take you? To what distance, to what accomplishment is now available with this sense that all people in the New World are, quote, American? Well, let's take a look at one of the pivotal moments in our history, in the history of the United States, and that would be the convening of the First Continental Congress. It's at this point, the First Continental Congress is called together. America is on the brink of revolution. At least we can say it's closer than it's ever been before. And 12 colonies will send delegates to Philadelphia to meet. Now, notice I said 12, not 13. And the reason that one colony is conspicuously absent is because the colony of Georgia declined, and it was a heated debate, to send delegates. Think of that. It wasn't that they weren't American. It wasn't that they weren't as American as their colonial brethren. It's that the British system to that point worked very well for them. They prospered under royal rule in Georgia. Remember, they are an agricultural colony. They are based on the plantation system. They need to sell large quantities of crops to make large quantities of money. And at this point in 1774, they are. So what we see here, at this great moment, this moment that we as a people collectively celebrate, is that America is still a very divided place. Rebellion, revolution, is a huge idea, and it's a dangerous idea. And more often than not in world history, that idea is a failure. So Georgia reveals a great deal to us. That collection of people in Savannah that met in January of 1775 could not get their act together, even at that point, even after the original convention of the First Continental Congress. They did not agree that separation from Britain was something that benefited them. And remember, these are not the 13 colonies as we know them. These are not 13 like-minded peoples. They do share an identity by the 1770s, but for the overwhelming majority of colonial American history, they are 13 separate entities with their own way of lives, seeking to make it the best they can on their own. So this is a time period of great mythology for us, and it's one that we cannot shy away from. The findings may not make us comfortable. The findings may not jive or compute with what we think is the truth. But the fact is, we're not doing ourselves any favors by not looking into this deeper. So the colonial American world in the 1750s and the 1760s and the 1770s, as we'll see through the remainder of the series, is a much more difficult and nuanced subject than we're probably prepared to confront on our own. These are the questions that historians ask. These are the questions, and these are the answers that you're seeking by listening to a podcast like this. It's what drives all of us as historians and history lovers and people interested in our past. Remember, history is not about finding something new, but it's about looking at something old in a new way. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.